Thank you very much. We're glad to be here this morning. It's been quite a while since I was here, and I recognize some whose names I'm supposed to know, but we are certainly glad to be here and appreciate the invitation. I want to talk to you about the Dead Sea Scrolls today. I suppose everybody has heard about them. What in the world does that have to do with our role as a Christian? Well, we tell people that they need to follow the Bible. They need to go book, chapter, and verse. And people will respond sometimes saying, how in the world do you know that the chapters and the verses, that the text that you have today is what the apostles actually wrote? Because it's been copied and copied and copied. And there's no way that could stay the same. Especially you go back to Isaiah and Jeremiah, the prophets, thousands and thousands of years ago, copying and copying. There's no way that what you got is exactly what they wrote. And you're trying to go by exactly what it says is just ridiculous in light of that. You ever heard that? How do you respond to that? Well, there are several ways. One of the ways would be with the evidence from the Dead Sea Scrolls. We do know that things do go downhill, and we're being told by a great many people that the Bible is one of those things, and it has eroded. And that's the basis for a number of religious movements in our country. Joseph Smith is basing his idea of the new revelation on the fact that the old one has been contaminated. And so you have to restore the purity with his Book of Mormon, which has nothing, very little to do with the New Testament anyway. Muhammad justified his revelation on the fact that the Jews had contaminated the Bible and it's totally different from what was revealed. And you have men like Bart Ehrman, who lectures on the college campuses across the country, telling about all of the variants in the manuscripts, just thousands of variants, and so you can't depend on that text at all. And of course, what he doesn't tell you is that, yes, there are some variants that you can see that are misspellings or changes in tense. Multiplied by over 5,000 manuscripts, and yeah, we got a lot of variants. But what's the relevance? And when you look at the significance of each one, it looks very different. But these are ideas that are being promoted. Muhammad says the Quran is directly from God, and that's what we can depend on. And Erdman says there are more variants than there are words in the Bible, which is not true. But there are many, simply because there are a lot of manuscripts. We only had a few manuscripts, that wouldn't be that many variants, which would work against his argument. We see in Isaiah chapter 40 the recognition of the fact that things do go downhill. The grass withers, the flower fades, the breath of the Lord blows on it. Surely the people are as grass. The grass withers, the flower fades. Anybody here not understand that? Everything is going downhill. But Isaiah says there is an exception to that. The word of our God stands forever. Now that's the claim that's made by Isaiah, and I think we can substantiate that when we look at the evidence from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Jesus, of course, said basically the same thing in Matthew 24 when he says, heaven and earth will pass away, but there's an exception. My word will not pass away. It's outside of that natural tendency that we see. Peter quotes Isaiah, says, all flesh is like grass, and the glory like the flower of grass. The grass withers, the flower falls off. But the word of our Lord endures forever, and then he extends it to that which was revealed to the apostles, that which was preached to them. All of that, according to Peter, is that which does not deteriorate. And I think that's really the only way we can explain the fact that we can demonstrate the text has not deteriorated. But the Dead Sea Scrolls help us do that. Let's talk about the discovery It's an intriguing, very interesting story, and we're just going to hit the high points this morning. William Albright, considered the dean of American archaeologists, says this is the greatest textual discovery or manuscript discovery of all time, and I think there's no question about that. Back in 1947, about half a dozen teenagers were tending some sheep, and Muhammad and Juma, that are pictured here, were among those teenagers. They had lost a sheep, thought he had crawled in a cave or maybe hiding back there. They threw a rock in, and they heard breaking pottery instead of a scampering sheep. And that was the discovery of those scrolls that had been put in jars to preserve manuscripts from the people who were living in the area. We've had a number of those teenagers that we've been able to talk with to tell us about that event. But they found scroll jars with scrolls in them. In that first cave, there were 37 scroll jars. They removed seven. The 37 disappeared with the Bedouins who put them on the open market, and I'm sure we have them back, but in pieces, and have paid quite a bit more that way. The seven of those scroll jars were sold to Mr. Kando, who was an antiquities dealer, lived in Bethlehem, had an antiquities shop in Jerusalem. It was a very interesting story, but we won't take time to tell the whole thing. He was with the Syrian Orthodox Church, one of the few Christians in Israel. About 2% of the population of Israel believe in Christ today. He had contacted Eliezer Sugnick, who was a professor at Hebrew University. He, together with Albright, identified these scrolls as being 2,000 years old. They just knew they were old scrolls. They didn't have any idea what they were initially. But he was able to purchase three of these seven scrolls. And they point out the fact that within 24 hours of that purchase, the United Nations, by two-thirds vote, passed the resolution creating the Jewish state. So they identify that event with the purchase of the scrolls, which was done. Of the seven scrolls purchased for $324. I helped negotiate the sale of a small piece for Liberty University just recently, a little bigger than a 50-cent piece, for $280,000. So the price has gone up, obviously. John Trevor of the Albright Institute verified and made famous and certainly raised the price. Mars Samuel, who was associated with Kando in the Syrian Orthodox Church, was able to purchase the other four, and he thought they were very important and, of course, was accurate. He eventually, though, put them up for sale in all places of the Wall Street Journal in 1954, and it's interesting that Sukhanik's son, Yigil Yedin, who was head of the Israeli underground, now this was before they had become a state, and then just after the history transcends the change, he saw the ad, and through an intermediary that wouldn't sell directly to a Jew, was able to purchase the rest of the scrolls so that the Jews came to have all seven. They're now displayed in the Scroll of the Book, this beautiful museum there in Jerusalem. Almost 1,000 of the scrolls now have been discovered in 12 caves. And it's a beautiful display, and especially the Isaiah scroll is stretched around the wall that we'll talk about in a moment. Let's consider the site of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is of course, near the Dead Sea, the northwest corner of the Dead Sea. The Qumran community was a community of renegade Jews, somewhat like the Sadducees, the Pharisees. They decided that the religion being practiced in Jerusalem was contaminated and polluted and Can you imagine that? They just pulled out, decided they would have no more to do with that, even though the Bible clearly specifies their worship must be there. But they started this group out in the wilderness, right on the northwest corner of the Dead Sea. The Wadi Qumran, Wadi is a fancy word, Jewish word for ditch, big ditch. And right beside that is where they had about 200 to 300 people for about 300 years. Now, that's quite an accomplishment in view of the fact that they didn't allow women, one of their unique rules. And without women, they lasted for 300 years, which is a strong recruiting program, I guess. This was excavated in the 50s, and right across the ditch there is Cave 4, where the majority of the scroll fragments were found. It revealed a complex of buildings that were dining halls, residences, immersion pools, watchtowers, and restored to look something like this. Maybe in this picture you can see, especially the immersion pools, they certainly believed in baptism about six times a day, was their view of it. The scriptorium was a two-story building that was obviously designed, I think, obviously, to copy scrolls. And they have these long benches. We found the inkwells, the pens that they were used for writing, and they would sew the sheepskin together to make the parchment and then produce the scrolls. They copied the scriptures as well as a number of other books. And their meticulous methodology is, I think, very instructive. We'll talk about it in a moment. This is my beloved here pointing out to one of the benches or two of the benches that were found that are now on display in Amman, Jordan. About almost 300 years before Christ, they began. By AD 66, the Jews in Jerusalem decided they're not going to give tribute to Rome anymore, which was not the best idea they ever had. They sent the 10th Roman Legion to destroy, and did ultimately destroy Jerusalem in 70 AD. On the way, they passed by Qumran, and in 68 AD, they completely wiped it out. The sect that was there saw them coming and understood what was happening and made the pottery and put the scrolls in the pottery and hid them in the caves. But by 68 AD, this was gone entirely. So that everything in those scrolls, we know, was done before 68 AD, which becomes significant. At least 11 caves, we've now found the 12th, actually this past year. No scrolls, but there were jars and wrappings where the scrolls had been. So that had been looted. We know where one more is, and we're working to get the permit to do the excavation there. This picture is about a quarter of a mile from the Qumran community. We were able to go up to several of these caves taken by Muhammad, one of the teenagers who helped discover the scrolls, who is now a Bedouin sheikh, a very distinguished individual. And through his grandson, Yosef Amari, we are able to communicate. He's one of the directors of the dig. He's a very accomplished archaeologist. But getting into those caves, this is Cave 1, where the Isaiah scroll was found. It is very interesting. Now, the opening that I'm in here was an artificial opening. The initial opening was higher, but it was made to help gain access. But to talk with these individuals and to hear them consider the fact that there may be others is a very interesting experience. The Bedouins found initially about 15,000 scroll fragments. Archaeologists found another 40,000. And now let's put all that together. That's a pretty formidable task, and you don't have a box top for this jigsaw puzzle. But they were fragments from about 400 manuscripts about 100 of them were a biblical text. And sometimes people will point to some of these that weren't biblical text and say, well, maybe these are inspired books that got left out. Most preachers have a pretty good library, and what percentage of the books in their library would be inspired books? Probably a pretty small percentage. Most of them are commentaries, maybe hymnals, and various books about the inspired books would comprise most of them, and that's true of this library as well. And it's obvious which ones they considered inspired and which ones weren't when you read their commentaries. Here we're looking inside cave 4, where most of the fragments were found, and especially in this crevice. And this is the way it appears today. If you go as a tourist, it's in Palestinian territory, but this is an area they allow tourists to visit, especially if you bring money. And you can climb the watchtower and look at the scriptorium. We had an archaeological dig on this site. The particular site encircled there was originally the garbage pit. And you can learn quite a bit about a community by looking at their garbage. A lot of people thought maybe this is where John the Baptist came from, out in the wilderness. But then you look at the garbage, and it's they ceremonially buried many of their feasts, which were lavish, with lamb, and buried the bowls with the bones in them, wine jars. It doesn't sound like John the Baptist to me. Very different community. But you can learn a good deal about them. It's not the best working conditions. It's about 130 degrees in the afternoon. It's early in the morning is the time to do the work. We start about 2 in the morning. And looking at a site here, this is a trench that started out obviously pretty shallow. Got to be about 7 feet deep, but we moved a lot of dirt and found quite a bit of information. Dr. Randall Price, you see pointing there, was the director of the dig. He's been with us up on Mount Ararat several times, and is a good friend. He's professor of Judaic Studies at Liberty University. He was the one that got the permits for us. We're looking here at some of the activity moving the dirt up on the hill. The fellow on the top is a grad student there from Dallas. And they don't always work that hard. You point a camera at them, and it really, the work really gets done. Joseph Omari, the grandson of Muhammad that we showed you a moment ago, is shown here helping to direct the dig. And it's an honor to work with individuals like that and with his grandfather and watch him speculate about where there may be more caves. This is an Ovid jar, which we found in the excavation. It's for wine, and it came from Jerusalem. It was made in it. Some of the skeptics had said this is just a pottery factory. Well, no, the pottery didn't come from here, which we demonstrated. We found a number of the cooking vessels and coins, which are very effective in dating. But one of the responses had been from the liberals. Now, they don't really care that much about the scriptures. They weren't really copying scriptures here. This was just a pottery factory. And the scrolls came from Jerusalem, and the Jews there brought them down and hid them. And the people in Qumran had nothing to do with that. So we excavated the garbage pit and found these bones buried ceremonially in there, right after the feast, with the lamb bones there. Comparing the lamb bones then with the parchment, the sheepskin, we could see that the DNA matched. The bones in the meals matched the DNA in the scrolls. So these were the ones that were copying the scrolls, and so that liberal argument was refuted. And that still has not been published. It'll be published maybe next month. They can put up resistance when they have arguments that are detrimental to their position. Let's consider the contents. of the Dead Sea Scrolls. About 400 are secular books, some of them pseudo-apocryphal. That was the style at the time, the highly figurative language. But from their commentaries, it's obvious they did not consider these to be inspired, but this was a style of literature at the time. About 200 are from sectarian texts, from hymns and prayers, from letters, from commentaries. But about 200 of the scrolls are of biblical manuscripts. Almost all of them are parchment, the sheepskin. The papyrus, which is the reed paper, wasn't used until the first century, but that pretty well dates the first century. And here we're looking at pictures of Psalms and Samuel. We have whole or fragmentary copies of every book of the Old Testament except Esther. And we do have Esther referred to in some of the commentaries. They knew about it, but not in the scrolls. So we wondered about that. Maybe it's because of their prejudice against women. But all of them except Esther are there. The most important ones are the Paleo-Hebrew manuscripts. This is pre-exile style, and you can tell the difference very obviously. It's kind of like the difference between printing and cursive. The square letters that is typical of the Hebrew today didn't begin until after the exile. Before the exile, they used what would be more like our cursive style. And there are 12 scrolls in that Paleo-Hebrew pre-exile period. That's significant because our liberal scholars today will get around the implication of prophecy by saying, well, no, that wasn't written until much later, after the exile, and after all the prophecies about the captivity and the return were accomplished, then they wrote it. And you study Isaiah. Well, you don't study Isaiah in the seminaries today. You study Isaiah 1 and Isaiah 2. And Isaiah 1 is when Isaiah lived. Isaiah 2, where the prophecies are, is after the exile. And when we found it all intact, I think that blew up the argument. Plus the fact that it was written in the Paleo-Hebrew. Here are some of the commentaries. This gives us a good deal of insight into what they were thinking at the time. Especially their view of the Messiah is significant. And our liberal friends will tell us the idea of Jesus as the Son of God didn't develop till hundreds of years after the New Testament. This was the mythology that developed over time. No, it wasn't a spin put on the writing after Christ. It was actually derived from the prophecies before Christ, some several hundred years before Christ, that they understood exactly what was expected of the Messiah and viewed him as the pierced Messiah, as the resurrected Messiah. Well, how would they know that? Well, you remember Peter on the day of Pentecost quoted David, his flesh would not see corruption. This was a prophecy that they understood in Qumran hundreds of years before the apostles came to understand it after they finally saw Christ resurrected. The Isaiah scroll particularly is interesting. It is complete, entire, from one end to the other, written in Paleo-Hebrew from cave one, not one and two. Interestingly, the red mark that you see here, pointed out by the arrow, is where they designate messianic passage. And they put the red points exactly where I would put them. I think they understood it. Most books about the Dead Sea Scrolls written today will tell you there's nothing about the New Testament there. It's all Old Testament, which is mostly true. Till you get to Cave 7, and it was not well preserved. The roof was collapsed, the sides likewise. And so the scrolls had deteriorated considerably. And they were not written on the parchment. They were written on papyrus, which is not as durable. But you had a number of fragments that were able to determine with writing on them at least 18 fragments. They were not written in Hebrew. They were written in Greek and written on the papyrus, not the parchment. So we're looking at first century material written in Greek. What are we looking at here? They are, of course, convinced, the Jews, that this had to be Old Testament material, like the rest of what we find from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they used computer analysis to see if they could match these passages. And with that process, they found Exodus and they found Jeremiah. The rest of them didn't fit at all because they weren't from the Old Testament. They weren't looking at New Testament material. But finally, Jose O'Callaghan, who is a Spanish papyrologist, one who studies ancient writing, said, let's just use the same technique to look at the New Testament. When he did, he found that they were all identifiable, particularly this passage from Mark that we have circled. It's not a very big passage or big piece with a lot of information, but with the computer technology, I think it was clearly identified. If you superimpose Mark 6 over this text, you see, okay, the top word fits pretty well, but the rest of it is a mess. But then how wide were the margins? Well, you don't really know just from the fragment, but it's very easy with computers today to adjust the margin. And when you do, bingo, it fits top to bottom. And the most diagnostic factor is here in the second line from the bottom, this longer word on the right, is the word Gennesaret, which is a unique word for the Sea of Galilee that was pretty peculiar to the New Testament times. And so here is a New Testament document referring to the Sea of Galilee right there in Mark 6, and the rest of the text fits. That's pretty good evidence that we have an example of Mark. Well, the implication there is here is Mark before 68 AD, when all of this was sealed up and the community was destroyed. Using that technology, he's actually identified these texts from Mark, likewise from 1 Timothy, from 2 Peter, which has been contested by some of the liberal scholars, and from James, from Acts, which would indicate all of these texts were there that existed at the time of the eyewitnesses, certainly before 68 AD. And from the style of the letters, it indicates more like 50 AD. And we think of that in terms of Mark 13. Now, this is not Mark 13, but if this part of Mark is here, the rest of it is somewhere. And in Mark 13, Jesus referred to the buildings of the temple. You see these great buildings. Not one stone will be left on another that will not be torn down. When did that happen? That happened in 70 AD. But here is the documentation that Jesus said this at least 2 years before it happened. Probably more like 20 years before it happened. But proof that the prophecy was made before the event. That becomes very significant, and you can understand why the liberal scholars really get upset when you start talking about the New Testament from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The significance goes in a number of directions. It demonstrates first that the view of these renegade Jews, sometimes hundreds of years before the time of Christ, of Scripture and of prophecy was just exactly what you and I would think when we look at the Scripture today. It destroys the idea that the faith of the New Testament was developed over hundreds of years. No, it was there hundreds of years before Christ. And like Jesus and the apostles, the Scriptures predicted the coming Messiah. He was a suffering and executed and a resurrected Messiah, and one that would judge from the throne of God at the end of time. Now, that was understood by the community at Qumran before Christ came. That tells us We're not twisting the scriptures when we say these prophecies pointed to Christ. You know, well, you're just making it fit. And all that. Before it happened, they understood it and figured it out. The accuracy of the transmission of scripture is certainly significant, and we see this emphasized when we look at the methodology of their copying. They would count the letters in each line and then tally the count from each line at the bottom. And if the tally wasn't accurate, then they had to white it up and start over. And so they very carefully, meticulously copied each letter. And that methodology would guarantee an accurate transmission. And with that, they produced every book of the Old Testament, with the exception of Esther. And we have documentation from the Dead Sea Scrolls of the text over 1,000 years older than any manuscript that we had at the time of the discovery. In other words, when this was discovered, the oldest Old Testament text that we had was the Aleppo Codex. The Leningradus was virtually the same thing. But that's 900 years after Christ. Well, 900 years, you could make a lot of changes and things could be added and taken back and forth. And so Joseph Smith and Muhammad was able to say with some credibility to the thinking of some, maybe they did change this. As far back as we can go, it was 900 years after Christ. But now then, with the Dead Sea Scrolls, we jump back 1,000 years. The oldest would be Genesis, which goes back to 300 years before Christ, and of course copied from a manuscript older than that. Well, how does it compare? Here's the Isaiah scroll at 125, beautifully preserved, B.C. In 1,000 years, how much changes, how many changes took place? And virtually none. When we look at the comparison, it's identical, word for word, in more than 95% of the text. And of that 5%, it's tenses, spelling. There's absolutely nothing that can be pointed to that is significant in terms of doctrine or that would affect faith. When we see the comparison and see no substantive difference, 1,000 years didn't change it. Now, I don't think that happened naturally. I think naturally that wouldn't. I understand the argument. But it didn't. And we can prove that it didn't from those texts that we found 1,000 years older than the oldest that we had at the time. That says Muhammad was wrong. And Joseph Smith was wrong. That they didn't remove plain and precious parts. And Bart Erdman's varieties, variants that he demonstrates do not substantiate his claim at all. And they're not fair and not really honest. When we look at the New Testament, the significance becomes very significant. Looking at the statements by the Jewish authorities, they will say that the latest autograph, that is, the one actually written by the author, was written about 325 B.C. That's the latest that we have. Well, the oldest Dead Sea Scroll is about 300 B.C. That's rather conservatively dated. So we've got 25 years from the original autograph to the oldest Dead Sea Scroll, less than a generation removed from the original, and it's the generation closest to the original. We see 1,000 years didn't make any difference. 25 years closest to the original. Is it reasonable to think there's significant change there? I don't believe it is. With regard to the New Testament, we have proof that these passages were written during the lifetime of the eyewitnesses and before the events actually occurred. Now that is where the liberals just really have a knockout punch. They don't have answers. Especially when you compare it to other documents, ancient documents, and there are many that we have in history, like Homer. We have 673 manuscripts of Homer. The earliest is 300 B.C., but it was written 700 B.C. So we're 400 years removed from the original. That's the best we can do with Homer. With Herodotus, a very famous historian, we've got 8 manuscripts. But it's over 1,000 years removed from the original. Plato, about 1,000 years removed from the original. With Aristotle, likewise, almost that. Caesar, close to 1,000 years removed from the original. That is the best manuscripts that we have. Josephus, we've got 9 manuscripts. He wrote about 70 A.D., but the oldest manuscript we've got is 400. A.D. 400. Tacitus, Roman historian, again 800 years removed. Compared with the New Testament, over 5,000 manuscripts. That figure is a little bit out of date. And even the liberal scholars will acknowledge some of it is within 50 years of the original. Nothing comes close. It's just not even beginning to compare with the validity of the substantial proof that we have for the New Testament. In addition to that, you have the commentaries that were written by the early church fathers. There are over 1 million quotations that have been documented from those early writings in the early centuries from the New Testament in their commentaries. And even Bart Erdman, together with Bruce Metzger, wrote a book acknowledging that all the sources of the New Testament, if they were all destroyed, that these quotations from the church fathers would be sufficient to reconstruct the entire New Testament. So if you didn't have any of the manuscripts, you could still reconstruct it from the commentaries. But we've got over 5,000 manuscripts, averaging 405 pages each. We got any mathematicians here? How many pages a manuscript? That's about 2.6 million pages of manuscripts. In addition, we have 10,000 Latin manuscripts. Some of them go back to the 2nd century. Coptic, Syriac, Georgian, Ethiopic, Armenian. But the very early manuscripts are the ones that are the most significant in terms of evidence. We have 2 confirmed fragments from the 1st century, confirmed in terms of the even the skeptics. 8 probable fragments, 16 contested. They will not generally accept Cave 7. I think they should. But that's contested. We have 12 manuscripts from the 2nd century that are uncontested, and 64 from the 3rd century, which tells us we've got over 100 witnesses within 200 years of the original autographs. Now, what classic Old Testament history or commentary or poetry, there's nothing in ancient history that comes close to that kind of documentation. And so when people say you can't depend on it, well, what about Plato? What about Caesar's commentary? Well, they don't question that, which is not reasonable. There are no substantive variants in any of these. So I think we are justified in concluding with Sir Frederick Kenyon, who was one of the most respected scholars of our age. He was 21 years head of the British Museum of Natural History, largest museum in the world. A very conservative scholar, that is conservative in terms of the evidence. He had to have evidence for what he was saying. He said it cannot be too strongly asserted that in substance the text of the Bible is certain. Especially is this the case with the New Testament. The number of manuscripts from the New Testament, of early translators, early translations from it, quotations from the oldest writers of the church, is so large that it's practically certain that the true reading of every doubtful passage in some one or other of these ancient authorities. This can be said of no other ancient book in the world. I think he knows what he's talking about. I think that's a defensible statement. I think it's true, which emphasizes exactly what Isaiah told us. Yes, everything is going to go downhill, except that word, which by God's providence is promised not to deteriorate. And I think that's the only way you can explain that lack of deterioration. We're reminded in John 12 that that word, which will not pass away, is the word that will judge us in the last day. Don't think it's going to go away. It's going to stare you in the face on the judgment day. And you need to be ready to face it. All right, our time is up this morning. Do we have time for questions? What time are we supposed to be through? 10:20. Okay, we've got... Let's see if some of you have some questions. Yes?
Nowadays, one of the reasons that they say that the Bible isn't valid is because they have so much anti-press against things. Do they find anything in old scripture, in old regular text that say that it was all a hoax?
Oh, that's been from day one.
I know the Jews went around from
sure.
Now.
Yeah, the apostles stole the body. We'll talk about that later this morning. There are always going to be people who refuse to believe, as we read in Luke 15, the five brothers of the rich man that was in Hades. They wouldn't believe if somebody came back from the dead. But they're not all like the five brothers, some people conclude sometimes. There are a lot of very honest people out there, and those are the ones who are supposed to be teaching. But yes, there will always be skeptics who refuse to believe no matter what. Even the religious leaders in Jesus' day, didn't matter what the evidence was. Yes, sir?
Sir, the Book of Enoch, was it found in these fragments?
Yes. Several copies of the Book of Enoch. And they referred to it in their commentaries. But like hundreds of other copies of the secular literature, it was obvious they did not consider it to be inspired. It was a history that was taken somewhat skeptically by some, more dependably by others, but yes, it was a part of that literature, but not considered inspired. Just like my library, most of the books there are not considered inspired. The fact that it's in my library doesn't mean that's what I think. Other questions? Okay. We've got 5 minutes worth of questions here. I could have added some more material, couldn't I? But let me stick one more point in here. I think I've got that. I ran across a quote the other day from Darwin, who was a believer in his early life. And he says, "I was very unwilling to give up my belief. I can well remember often inventing daydreams of old letters between distinguished Romans and manuscripts being discovered at Pompeii or elsewhere." Well, Pompeii was about 10 years later, 11 years after the Dead Sea Scrolls were destroyed. Well, maybe there's some manuscripts there that would verify the New Testament, which confirmed in the most striking manner what was written in the Gospels. Now, this was good evidence to Darwin. Well, why did he change his mind? He continues, "But I found it more and more difficult. I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity were true. For if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that men who do not believe, this would include my father and brother and almost all my best friends, would be everlastingly punished, and this is a damnable doctrine." So he didn't like it. The evidence may be there, and the evidence that he said would be good evidence is exactly the kind of evidence that we're talking about this morning, that was actually 10 years earlier than what he was talking about. But his sense of justice surpassed God's.
Yes. Going back, not meaning to elaborate too much on the subject of the Book of Enoch, but But why wasn't it considered inspired?
Well, you can see the way they talk about it. As they would talk about John Hyrcanus, some of the heroes of the time, but not prophets, and they're secular historians. And this is the way they discussed it. They wouldn't quote it like they would the Bible. The early church fathers looked at that. And you can see in some of the councils, some of the discussions, and they pointed out, well, nobody quoted it in the New Testament, and they didn't have access to what we have with the Dead Sea Scrolls. But you see the way they quote it. They didn't consider it inspired. Other questions? Good questions. Yes.
So John, we have other historians, not inspired folks, but we have other historians like Eusebius. What other historians are there that give an account or speak to the existence of Jesus that we just don't hear about?
Josephus spoke about him at length. And you've got some skeptics who begin to, at that point, when you point this out, well, you know, we're several years removed from the original Joseph, and I got content. they go back to the old saw that we're used to. But that's pretty unusual. That would be a rare. Josephus is pretty well accepted as a historian, and he has several passages that refer to Jesus. He even mentions the resurrection. He said there's evidence of that. He didn't affirm his faith, but it was implied, actually. Tacitus is another Roman historian who mentions that in a letter to Caesar about some of the uprising from the Christians who believed Christ was raised from the dead. So you've got at least two there that are very clear, and there are others that are possibly references. You've got some pictures even in Pompeii of, what do you call them, words arranged in pictures. What's the word for that? Anyway, the references to Christ. And some of them attacking Christianity. There's one of Christ implied riding on a donkey, and it's a cartoon making fun of Christ, but it testifies to the fact there was a Christ that people did honor that they needed to dishonor in their view. Even the cartoons testify that, yeah, he was there. All right, thank you very much for your questions.